Gemma Tarlak joins us for a look at some of the most compelling stories from the world of science, including the past and present of climate change in Mongolia, where a changing climate may have sparked Genghis Khan's rise to power, and where modern-day changes are endangering a way of life.
Gemma Tarlak is Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about some of the coolest science news. Gemma, welcome back.
Hi, always great to be with you. I missed you.
Well, you too. Well, now let's go to Mongolia, Gemma. Let's buy some plane tickets. Oh, no, wait. So this article, climate change may have driven Genghis Khan's rise to power, close to 1,000 years ago. How are these tied together?
Well, it's really interesting, and I love the way the geographer we profile in the story puts it. She says, nature set the table, and Genghis Khan came to eat. And basically, just as Genghis Khan was developing some political ambitions, that seems to be the theme today, it turns out that the weather really could not have been better. The climate actually could not have been better. It was mild. It was damp. There was a lot of grass growing. It was the perfect, perfect climate to raise a whole bunch of horses for the Mongol horde to ride all through Europe and Asia. So he really benefited from this, you know, very particular, unusual pattern, climate pattern, just that coincided just with the start of his rise. And they figured this out by looking at tree rings from trees that were growing during that era. And meanwhile, you know, these researchers, these dendrochronologists, are spending a lot of time in Mongolia, and they're, you know, experiencing the current Mongolian climate, the current culture there, and they realized that there is another cultural climate link that's not positive. I mean, it was great for Genghis Khan 800 years ago. You know, he rode all the way to success. But right now what's happening is we're entering a much hotter, drier climate period. And that, in addition to several man-made factors, is really wrecking Mongolia. And it's tragic. It's a tragedy unfolding right in front of us.
I want to go back and talk a little bit more about those tree rings. You said that's how researchers figured out that the climate was so hospitable for Genghis Khan and his horde. So how do the tree rings give us that information about what the climate was like?
Well, what they do is they look at trees that are alive now, and they find the tree ring patterns from, they're able to, you know, count back the number of years, because a ring grows in every year, and then they basically build up overlapping trees. So you find a tree that was alive from 1960 until now, and then you find a tree that was alive, say, from 1920 until 1980, and you look at that overlap of tree rings, and that's how you build this chronology further and further back in time. And so they found trees that were actually alive in the 11th and 12th and 13th centuries, and they were able to determine by the thickness and the composition of the rings what kind of climate it was. If it's a really mild, wet climate, that tree ring is going to be nice and fat and healthy. If it was a really lousy, dry climate, the tree ring is going to be, not so good, not so healthy. So they can actually determine climate by just looking at the tree rings.
Now, fast forwarding back to modern times, in this piece, Mongolia among the places in the world most affected by a warming climate.
Yes, it is. We're seeing already their temperature has increased more than 2 degrees Celsius, and the global average worldwide is just under 1 degree, I think. So it's even more than double the increase we've seen globally. And basically, in addition to a hotter, drier climate, it unfortunately coincided with some economic and cultural changes. People switched over their livestock from sheep to goats, and because it's, you know, you can make a lot more money selling the goat hair or pelts. I'm sorry, I'm not a Mongolian herder. I don't know what it's called, but you can make a lot more money with goats than you can with sheep. And so they switched over to goats. But the problem is, you know, the sheep kind of nibble at the grass. The goats just tear it up and leave nothing. So in addition to this hotter, drier climate as a result of global climate change issues, they're also desertifying their land by having their goats graze it all the way down to just dirt.
And you said that climate change is hitting Mongolia especially hard. Why is it that Mongolia is a flashpoint for climate change?
Well, it's a number of reasons. It's in a continental climate. You know, it's kind of right smack in the middle of Asia, and so it doesn't have mitigating factors like a lot of the maritime countries do. And there are a number of issues, but it's really just kind of, unfortunately, it's a perfect storm of conditions that is really wrecking it.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine about some of the most compelling stories from the world of science. And Gemma, a brighter note, a special section in Discover on powering the future, looking at some of the different ways people are addressing climate change, carbon emissions. One of the things you look at is stellar energy, solar panels, right? We know what those are, but in space, in Earth's orbit. Tell us how that works.
Yes, space-based solar power. And as you mentioned, it's part of our special section on energy. So if you read the Mongolia story and you get really down, don't worry. We have a lot of really good news about the climate and about energy in the magazine as well. Basically, there are these huge arrays, and there are a few different designs. One of them looks like a giant tulip or a giant bell shape. And they put the photovoltaic panels up in space. And, of course, you get, 35 to 70% more intense sun rays than you would on the ground. And the sun shines on those panels without worrying about clouds or smog or anything. The panels actually convert it to energy, which is then beamed to Earth. So, and the panels, I should also add, they can be in a geosynchronous orbit, which means it's always sunny where the panels are. So it's actually, they think, like the same size array in space would get 40 times more energy than it would on Earth. So it's a huge, huge energy, resource.
Without getting too technical, how do you beam energy back to Earth?
Very carefully. No, but seriously, there are some safety concerns, and in the designs they have, and they've been thinking about this since the 1960s, quite frankly, but in the designs they have, they look at either microwave beams or a particular kind of infrared laser beam, and they have all kinds of safeguards so that it would beam down to a power station and, it would shut off automatically if the beam started going wayward or such. So there are some safety concerns, but they're working those out. And the great thing is there are no environmental concerns. It's a limitless source of energy.
How close are we to actually having this happen as launching things into space gets a little cheaper all the time?
Well, unfortunately, we're not as close as I wish we were, because the big issue here is indeed the cost. And, companies like SpaceX are all about lowering the cost, but that's not going to happen until they figure out how to get reusable rockets that are basically rockets as reusable as airplanes, because they're estimating it would take more than 10,000 tons of equipment to build one of these space-based solar power stations. And when you think about it, it costs, I think in our article we see something like $4,600 for every 2 pounds that they send it to space now just to launch it. When you're talking about 10,000 tons, I mean, you can't even fathom the cost. No pun intended, the costs are astronomical. But they're hoping as soon as that cost of getting stuff into space is lowered, the whole thing can be built by robots and operational with minimal maintenance for decades. So we're getting closer, but we're not there.
All right. Well, one thing sounds like we're a little bit closer to way back here on planet Earth is the city of Portland putting turbines into their sewer system. Now, what's going on there? How does that work?
Yeah, I love this. It's such a simple, elegant solution. What they've done is installed these special turbines into the water and sewage pipes in some areas where they're revamping the pipes. And basically, the water, it comes down the hill, it goes through and actually drives the turbine, which creates power. And right now in Portland, they're able to power about 150 homes just with what's going through the pipes and what would be going through the pipes anyway. So it's like this free source of energy that they're using. And I love it. It's such a great little project.
All right, Gemma, thank you so much, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Have fun.
That was Gemma Tarlak. She's Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month here on Central Time to look at some of the most interesting stories from the world of science and technology.